Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello, good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are. This is Russell Tovey.
And Robert Diamond.
And we are here with Talk Art.
Welcome to Talk Art.
Episode 2, we're back. So episode 1 went out and we were thrilled with the reaction from all you guys. And so this is episode 2, continuing our conversations about our friendship and art and the world we both live in.
And today we have a very special guest.
We do.
So our guest is someone that has inspired both me and Russell for pretty much the whole time since we got into art.
And our guest is now sit snugly between myself and Robert, penned in with no escape. This guest of ours has been not only a massive influence to us, but a humongous massive influence to the art world in general and the world as a whole. his ability to create work, his influence on so many artists, and his gift as a teacher of many, many, many influential, important artists is something that will be the most important thing ever.
Never.
We are so pleasured to have this man here today. He was made a CBE in
2016.
No.
Oh, no, sorry,
2008. 2002. He's a CBE, and then he got knighted in 2016. And he's also a Royal Academician.
I love this one because Russell was like abracadabra. He couldn't say the word academician.
But he's got lots and lots of letters after his name. We are thrilled to introduce Sir Michael Craig Martin, CBERA. Welcome, Michael.
As Russell, as you well know, I never use any of those titles, certainly not Sir, nor any of the others. Other people do. The only place where I use the Sir is on my British Airways card.
Someone else told me that, who's a dame. She said she loves being called like dame, only at British Airways.
Only at British Airways, because there's the slight, although I have to say very slight possibility that you might get upgraded.
That's hilarious.
But other than that, I can't see any reason why that I just feel embarrassed using it.
I think that's reason enough to become a sir. I'll get upgraded on your flights everywhere.
No, if that was true, I would tell you, but it's not. Unfortunately, it's rare, very rare.
The first question we wanted to ask you was, what is your favorite color? Because we thought it was like such a simple beginning.
Yeah.
Well, I wouldn't have known how to answer that, 15 or 20 years ago, but it clearly has to be magenta.
Oh, sassy. Nice.
Magenta.
Well, it's the polite way of saying pink.
Yeah.
But kind of
purple deep, shade, deep. Isn't it?
It's redder than purple.
Right.
And it's like a deep pink. Pink is a basically a pastel color, and that's magenta is not. It's more full bodied than that.
Ooh.
I use a very basic palette, which is only about 10 or 12 colors actually, and everything else is just a variation.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. And that's the palette that I use, and I try to use everything at the maximum pitch, mm-hmm. the highest intensity that I can get. And I discovered from use that magenta magenta is a very artificial color. It was only invented. This is so amazing. It was only invented in the 19th century.
Really?
As a color. Yeah, it didn't exist exactly as it
really?
Is now.
That's so cool.
It's so weird to think that a color could be invented.
What is the combination then that would have made
I don't know exactly how it was chemically done. They had some things that were kind of equivalent, but they weren't exactly the same before that.
And would that be your go-to? So say you're making a work of art, would your default be like, I'm going to go for the magenta, and you have to stop yourself, or...?
Yes, because I have a tendency to overuse it, because... Mm. And the thing is, it has an amazing capacity to make everything near it look better.
What, other colours?
Other colours.
Amazing. In reference to other
colours. It has an extraordinary effect that no other colour... You'd think it would draw a lot of attention to itself, but it doesn't. That's why, you know, I did the summer show at the Royal Academy.
Right, you curated it.
In 2015, wasn't it?
A couple of years
ago. Yeah, I remember that.
And the main room, I painted the room magenta. And it's a room, you know, in which there may be 50, 60 paintings by other people are going to hang. And it took a bit of nerve to actually think, well, I can put all these other pictures.
And for them, did it take them?
They didn't know, or they were very... wary that anybody would do this. But because I've used it so much, I knew that it would not hurt things, that it would make them actually look great. It would make them look
great.
And nobody complained to me about their painting.
Hanging on a magenta wall
once it was there. The thought of it was a lot of people found off-putting, but when they actually saw it, it's very hard to... Because it brings a kind of clarity to the other color. I don't know why. And I have never found another color that does the same thing.
And why do you work at the most vibrant of a color, do you think? Why are you drawn to pitching it up to its...
To the max.
Yeah.
I don't know. I have no subtlety. I didn't use color really at all in my work I didn't really start using it until I was in my 50s.
Because your work was the line.
There was a tendency to black and white. Yeah. And you know, when my work was considered more conceptual, well, in conceptual work, you're kind of allowed black and white and maybe a little red. Mm-hmm. You'd have red occasionally. Mm-hmm. But that color range, anything other than that, is too indulgent. Mm-hmm. And so you get very little use of color. And that was part of my way of thinking about things. And then something happened in the work, and I started with painting rooms, not things, colors. And when I painted the rooms, the impact, and I went to Dulux, and you can get amazing colors.
What do you mean rooms, like as in as a gallery space?
A gallery space, yeah.
And wall murals, no?
I did an exhibition in Rome. And I colored the walls, and it was the first time I'd ever painted the room before putting the images on them.
Right.
And I'd never done that before. And it was a revelation. And then the next show I had was in Paris, and I had a gallery in Paris. You know those courtyards, there's a little courtyard, and there's rooms all the way around the edge of the court, the center space, the rooms around the outside. And there were seven rooms. And all more or less the same size. And I told the gallerist, and she had seen the show in Rome, and she loved it. And so I said, I want each room to be a different color. Well, what are you going to do? Red, yellow, blue. Mm. So that's what I did. I just used the basic color.
Richard of York, and I tried to get the in vain.
I just went to Dulux. I got the best one, what seemed to be the brightest color. So they would seem very identifiable. It's like when I draw an object, I never draw an object that's obscure.
Yes.
I want you to look at it
and know exactly what it is.
If you have to figure out, I've lost you already.
Right.
Well, I read that the one object that you struggled with was the metronome. That was the one that pinged out where people didn't know what that was.
Not everybody
kids,
seems to
a lot
know.
Of kids didn't like, understand what that was.
No, and these days, of course, I've had to stop using tape cassette, the drawing of the tape cassette too, because no young person has any idea what a tape cassette is.
Mm-hmm. Although, didn't you do one recently which has the Spotify logo with the tape cassette?
Yes, I did.
On top of each other.
Yes, because... And that was about the change in objects over time.
Yeah.
And what's really amazing is with the tape cassette, which is really extraordinary to think now, it has two little wheels in it, and there's a bit of tape that actually passes physically from one wheel to another.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That's how mechanical the
world... Prehistoric.
It's so prehistoric now, doesn't it? It's not that long ago.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, then we went to CDs. DVDs, and that's pretty, that's pretty, you know.
And they try to get MP3s
But now the fact is you can have music without having any object at all.
Yeah.
And that's why I thought the Spotify symbol had replaced the object.
Totally, yeah.
Because you don't need an object.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to buy anything. You know, the logo. The whole thing, thing exists in the world of the logo.
Yeah, true.
And that's a very big change in...
Well, it's
the nature of things.
Yeah.
Big change. So you're going from two little wheels turning in a plastic
to a logo.
Box to a logo.
It's like Prince, and that, isn't it? Yeah. It just turned into a symbol.
It just turned into a symbol. And, you recognize the symbol the way you would have recognized the object.
Exactly. So go back to the Paris exhibition.
Oh, yes.
So
I painted the rooms.
Yes.
I painted the rooms, and then I painted images of two objects in each room.
So these were wall works?
I just painted them. I painted one room entirely red, one room. And you went from
the
one
objects
color
on top,
room.
I mean.
And then the objects were painted on top of the wall.
With the
and
tape.
And I did paint, I drew them with tape, and then I filled them in.
Yeah.
And I was timid with the color in the objects, so I painted them in kind of semi-naturalistic colors.
Yeah.
But the rooms were very vivid.
Yeah.
Wow.
And it was a transformative experience for me because people came and were overwhelmed by what they saw. You could see it. People were smiling. People were engaging with the work in a way that I'd never experienced.
Well, is it the Rothko feel, like when you're in front of or engulfed with colour,
it's engulfing.
It can affect you.
It's engulfing. Yeah. And I never understood what it meant about the relationship between emotion and colour.
Yes.
And people would come, you know, grown-up people or little kids would come, and their faces would light up in certain rooms because of the colour.
Mm. Isn't that amazing?
And I didn't have to do anything. You know, the colour just
it's
did.
The experience.
Just the experience and the excitement of going from a yellow room to a magenta room, to a blue room.
What was your darkest colour?
The darkest colour was probably, there was a darkish blue.
What was that like, the feeling in
there? That was the most sombre. It was the least electric of the rooms. It's interesting. Oh. And that was one of the reasons why I got interested in the intensity, because the rooms that had the biggest impact were the ones where
you really physically felt it for granted.
And you did have a physical, that was interesting. See, it was
physical partly, reaction.
It was a kind of physical, whatever you called that, a kind of...
it's like
osmosis.
Something really...
You take it into yourself.
You really take it into yourself.
Yeah.
And that
yeah.
was really... you know, frankly, ever since that time, I hardly do anything that doesn't involve this color. I mean, eventually, I transferred that kind of color into the objects themselves, which I didn't do initially. Mm-hmm. And in the beginning, I only did these big installations where there were rooms with objects in them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then I thought, I wanted a way of being able to do this in the studio. I wanted to be a way of being able to spend more time with something that I made.
Mm.
And so I started to try to figure out how to transfer what I was doing in the rooms into paintings that would become discrete objects.
The paintings
came out of the installations.
Right. Well, you do take for granted how in art color affects you. I mean, one of your massive influences is Joseph Albers. And you talk about him a lot in your book that me and Rob have been reading.
Yeah, it's called On Being an Artist. And it's just an incredible book. I'm in love with this book so much, I can't tell you.
It's like one of these
I've only recently discovered it. And
you can
I don't
just
know
pick
how
it up and
I didn't
put it
have
down.
It before. I just love it because it's basically like your paintings are. It's totally you, which is obviously, I know you wrote it, but it's like the actual approach to the book because it's like almost like very short chapters and their comments on different things, like on your first public commission, on, you know, all different.
But I wrote the book. I wanted the book to be a book that I could bear to read myself.
Right.
And I find, I don't know whether it's my age or whether it's a change in the climate of the times and the way we all use computers and everything. I find it very, very difficult to sustain an entire book anymore.
Mm-hmm.
I start books and I get partway through and then I glaze over and I never finish it.
Do you know what? I'm exactly the same. And I don't know if it's part of this whole way we're living now. The way
I think it must be.
It must be because I find it really hard
too.
I struggle.
And I look back and I think, my God, I read all those books. And I used to get interested in an author. I'd read everything the author wrote.
Yeah.
I couldn't imagine doing that now.
Yeah.
And So I wrote the book with, so there are bite-sized, everything is in a bite-sized chapter.
Yeah.
And there's something like, I don't know, 150 chapters.
Yeah, yeah, it's incredible.
And so, but the, also the idea was that there's a kind of basic chronology.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
More or less. You could read the book from beginning to end if you want to, yeah. Or you could just open it any page.
There's no pressure. You can dip in and out.
You can dip in and out.
And you get
each chapter is a thought in itself.
Yeah. And for me, it was a bit like, I used to read poetry a lot when I was growing up, and it was a bit, it reminds me of that. That's the kind of experience I have where you go in and you might read one or two poems.
Do you know what it is for me? It's like Andy Warhol's diaries. It's like, I can't read them cover to cover, but I will flick through and then you'll read something and it's there by the bed.
He's not interested.
No, he doesn't want you to read. No,
he
doesn't
want you to do that. There are people who interested me a great deal about the way they wrote. And one of them was John Cage, who's writing in, you know, the book called Silence is a fabulous book if you haven't read it. It's absolutely amazing. And he did this wonderful thing of mixing different kinds of writing. Mm-hmm. So there's little short bits and then there's longer bits and there's bits that are very funny and bits that are very serious. And I really liked, I liked that. And I like things like the way Beckett writes, which again is it's very precise. You can take bits out of Beckett and just read them.
It's so pared down. Yes, yes, yes.
And that, of course, that's what interests me.
Yeah.
One of the things I loved was when you speak about talking about art and how you should speak about art and how you can get very lost with flowery, over-the-top press releases about a contemporary art when actually it's about being direct and about having the right words to describe things. And it doesn't need to have like 10 pages of description. It could be like a paragraph. Mm-hmm. And because that's actually, in a way, the hardest thing, you know, to do. But I feel like that's what this book has succeeded in, and also your work succeeds in, because it's that directness. And that's what I've always loved about your work.
The thing that I felt, from, you know, really from the time I was a student, was that a lot of what was said to me, I didn't understand it. I hear these words and it sounds great. But first of all, I don't really understand it.
Yeah.
And second of all, how can I use it?
Yeah.
Is it practical? And what I, one of the things I loved about Albers that I learned from Albers was Albers' idea was there was no need to study color theory if you were an artist. Studying color wheels and all that stuff, he considered it an absolute waste of time because it didn't actually help you when it went to using color. To use color, you needed the practice of using color, and you needed to learn certain things through the practice of doing it.
Of actual making,
rather than having a theoretical construct that you would bring to the experience. Because the theoretical construct, when you came to, it's absolutely fine theoretically, but when you came to make your picture, it was useless.
Yeah.
And
I actually had a conversation with Rebecca Warren about this last week, about this idea that like you can make a sculpture and that's enough somehow. Like, you know, in making it, the ideas are going to inherently be within that work.
But, and what I realized was that a lot of people don't seem to understand that the work of art is itself the expression. It is, the thought is in the work. It isn't in the conversation about the work. It isn't about, there isn't the work and then I tell you about it and the thing I tell you about it is more important than the thing itself. The thing itself is the word.
Yes.
It's because it's the artist's hand.
It's the artist's hand.
It's because it's, whatever you, whatever your life has taken you up to that point, you've created that piece of art, whatever that is at that point, because that's where your journey's taken.
And I feel very strongly, it's because it's in the book, that essentially the most important aspect of oneself as an individual is the part you can't help. The part that over which you have no control, that you are who you are, and you try, even if you try to hide this, even if you try to manipulate it, it doesn't work because the actual you
is coming out through it.
It'll always surface.
I think if you're anybody creative, that is, it, you have to draw on yourself, and as soon as you try and hide from yourself, then the work is not going to be true.
It's never going to work. You know that. As anybody creative knows, will truly creative understands that, and that's. But that's a very important thing for everybody to understand.
Can I go personal on you now? Then with that, so so with that in mind, before you really accepted your own sexuality, do you feel like the work you was creating before differed, like, massively after you accepted your own
What did it change?
Did it change? What do you like saying that when you use your true self to yourself? Do you feel like your work altered at all? I know you say that you do talk about your work and you don't feel like it has the art. You don't want people to see the artist, but in yourself, could you have seen a difference?
Well, it's a funny question. I don't quite know that I can give you a straightforward answer. All I can say to you is that the work of mine, the Oak Tree, which is really the kind of is a pivotal point
seminal
in my work.
Yes.
Mm. But it's very important for me because there's the work before that.
Yes.
And then there's the work after that.
Mm.
And that occurred virtually at the time that I was married and I was separated from my wife.
Mm-hmm.
And when I did that, I look back and it's interesting. I immediately wanted to tell everybody that I was gay.
Yeah.
Mm.
Everybody around me. I even told my students, you know, I was having a tutorial with somebody, and I say, you know, I just wanted to let you know. I don't know what they thought.
Mm. Yeah.
Well, basically, and what was really interesting, which I think most gay people discover this to their surprise, is that when you come out, it's not as traumatic as you have imagined
to
be.
Exactly, no, yeah.
No. And that people are amazed. People are frankly
don't care. They're like,
actually indifferent.
Prophet, yeah.
Who cares? Who cares?
It's quite self-indulgent how much you think people are going to be affected by you.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And actually, nobody knows what to say. You know, what do you ever say about it?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, and people really don't care. And the thing that struck me was it was interesting. I told the people I worked with, and several of them came out to me, which did surprise me.
At the same conversation.
The same conversation.
Wow.
I had never even thought about before. But with the students, it was, could we get on with it? Could we talk about my work now?
Yeah,
because,
yeah.
Because, you know, it was like so
unintriminal.
It was so uninteresting.
Yeah.
And I think I'm going through this traumatic moment of revelation.
Yeah.
And they're thinking, can we talk
so
about
do
my painting?
I should go with magenta? Yeah.
But it took me a long time. I would say it took me about 5 or 10 years to really come to terms with things in my work.
Yeah.
And that's the beginning then of the drawings, and then the drawings lead me to the, and then the color, you see, but the color comes quite a bit after. I've been doing the drawings for a long time before mm-hmm. the color enters in. And I feel like what I've ended up with, the Oak Tree, which is very particular.
We're going to talk about Rob's going to talk about the Oak Tree.
Yes. Well, the thing is, it's very critical thing to me.
Yeah.
Right.
But it also, it's not a body of work. It's a work.
Mm.
The body of work of what I've done, if I think of what I've done that I see as important, is the work of the last 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Which is the drawings and the paintings, the things using the images and the color. Those to me, that's the body of work, which is
defining.
Yeah. Okay. Now, there's other things I did previous to that, especially the Oak Tree, but other things, I'm very pleased about, but they don't constitute the same.
Right.
They're interesting asides, and I think lots of artists do things which are kind of interesting. So.
And I always found when I first knew and saw the Oak Tree, it was very much like a springboard for me or something. It was like a kind of, it's almost like it sums up so much about
We should
faith.
Talk about what the Oak Tree is, because in people's minds now, if they don't know Mark Craig Martin's work and what the Oak Tree is, you're imagining an oak tree.
Yeah.
But what you're actually seeing is a glass shelf that's high up on the wall with a glass of water in it, which Michael Craig Martin has decided is an oak tree.
And next to it is a text on the wall in red.
In red,
which is the colour you said you were allowed to use in conceptual art.
Exactly.
Very good.
Exactly. You cut that right. No, you're absolutely right. Yeah, it was permissible.
And there's a conversation in this text, question and answer.
Yes.
The text was very carefully written, but it's in the form of an interview, like mm-hmm. a dialogue,
mm-hmm.
and it's between, say, the artist and a viewer, but it's also between a believer and a skeptic.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
I believe it, but I don't know.
And a critic, isn't it?
It's a critic in the art. And it was, in a sense, me trying to anticipate every criticism that could be made of the work and putting it into the work.
Yes.
So the work contains both its own assertion mm-hmm. and its own denial.
Yes.
So it sums up a lot, which is, you know, really what I wanted to do. And it proved a problematic work for me because it was so absolute. that it either was an opening to me to do anything I wanted, or it was a
limited,
like a trap. It was such a trap. And everything I tried to find other oak trees.
Yeah.
Well, they were always much less than the...
Than that, yeah.
I could never... You can only hit that thing occasionally.
Yeah.
And I was lucky and got one.
You struck gold with that one.
I struck
gold. So that was a game changer.
It was, but it did undermine, in a certain sense, what I had been doing.
Got
because
it.
I couldn't imagine how I could do this again. Mm. And my career is a... I have to say, I have never found a single thing that does such an absolute thing.
It's very kind of off-center from what you're saying you are defined by, which is your drawings and your painting.
But the thinking in it is exactly the same.
Exactly the same. And that's the thing. It's like this summation of ideas about what contemporary art is and what art is and what your... Because for me, I got into contemporary art because it was like a soul thing or something. And for me, it's almost like... It was not religious, because it's not religious, but it's almost like if you believed in something, I believe in art to the core of me.
Yeah.
And creativity. And that work sums it all up, because it's like this idea of belief and faith. And I have faith in artists. I'm the most happy when I'm with artists and with creativity. And that's why that work, when I first learned about it maybe 20 years ago or something, I found it so kind of important, because it was just like the summation of things. But it's like the start point in a way for me, and then that's in a way what it was for you. Because
it was exactly the same for me.
Yeah.
It was exactly the same for me. And
this work was made in 1973.
Yeah.
So it's like, you know, an early work for you in a way. And I just think it's still just as important now for people to learn about, you know, as it was then.
Well, the thing that I realized about, because it was a time when a lot of people were thinking about what is the essence of art.
Yeah.
That was a big question for artists in the
Minimalism
was the late 60s. That was very, and then that minimalism kind of bled into conceptualism, early conceptualism. And a lot of the thinking was, you know, what do you need for a work of art? What is essential? And that was the context in which I was thinking. And I suddenly realized that if you didn't believe in something, it doesn't work.
Mm.
You have to give yourself to it in a way.
Mm-hmm.
To a poem, you can read a poem and it's dead. You have to allow it to be a poem.
Exactly.
And if you enter it in that spirit, then it can, it may not, but it at least it can. But if you don't do that, it's never going to work. And you have to allow a work of art
to be a work of art.
Mm. And that's really an act of faith. And I mean, it's something which is very close to the kind of thing that one has in religious faith. But as you say, it's not religion, but it is to do with a letting go of the kind of some kind of feeling about their constraints that you can't, that the thing has to live up to, or something like that.
Mm.
People who are unhappy with the arts are usually people who are asking a question of it can't answer.
Got it.
It's not supposed to answer. It's not failing to answer. It's the wrong question.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
They want too much.
They want too much from it.
Yeah.
And the thing that's useful about art is that it answers the questions other things don't.
Mm. Totally.
Yeah, exactly.
It's separateness from other things. It's
by just being,
that makes it useful.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So that oak tree is part of the Tate collection, which was...
Well, actually, to be honest, the original, it was more extraordinary. It was, I had a little touring exhibition in Australia
we were going to bring this
in
up.
In about 1976.
Great story.
we'll get to this story. And there was about 12, 15 works of art of mine, and they've traveled to 5 different cities in Australia, and only one was sold, and to my amazement, it was the oak tree. And I had made it double the price of anything I had ever done, because I just assumed nobody would ever want it.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, who would buy a glass of water? So... It did actually get sold, but it did get sold to the National Gallery of Australia.
And but there was a problem getting into the country, because this is a glass of water, but it had been labelled as an oak tree. So it was caught up at customs.
Yeah.
And when you got there, that you was like, what's the problem? And they said, it's an oak tree, no vegetation.
It's so good.
And you had to stand there and go, well, actually,
it's just a glass of water.
Yeah. Which completely defined everything that you were... But that's amazing. Well, I saw it at the Tate Modern.
Yes.
So
I have an artist copy, which is on permanent loan to to the Tate.
Is it, when will it be shown again? Did I let you know?
Oh, no, I never know. It comes and goes.
Right.
It comes and goes. But I mean, the object, it was interesting because I first showed it in London, in my gallery in London at the time, the Rowan Gallery. I went to the director and I said, look, I wanted to show this thing and it's very important. There can't be anything else in the gallery.
Huh.
That's it. That's it. And then originally the text was a pamphlet. It was on the table at the store. You could take away. You could take away. The idea was there would be nothing.
Wow.
And 90% of the people who came to the gallery opened the door, looked in, thought nothing here, nothing.
and left.
I mean, I think hardly anybody actually saw it as an exhibition.
Wow.
And I have a photograph of the opening, and there's like 15 people standing around the desk where they have a bottle of cheap wine. That was how many people used to come to things in those days. I'm a very visual person. I only think of myself as a visual person. Mm. I think if I have any real capacities, they're essentially visual. And the only thing that upset me about the Odry was that I needed the text. Mm. And if I could have done it without the text, I would have done it without the text. But I realized I needed the text to be able to make it clear what I was doing. Mm. And that's why I thought the format of the question answer was useful. Mm-hmm. But I knew that I couldn't just say, call it an oak tree, because then all you're doing is changing the name. Mm. And I was trying to describe something much more fundamental that it doesn't even matter if you call it an oak tree. It actually is one. Mm. It isn't a symbol for an oak tree or anything. It actually
is one.
It actually is one. Despite all the evidence of your own eyes, you're wrong.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
So when we now think of your work, like the first thing I would think of if you said the word Michael Craig Martin to me is going to be colour, like bright colours. Mm. But funnily enough, for me, two of the most powerful moments I've had in relation to looking at your work, one was in Margate, because obviously you probably know Carl and I are opening the gallery in Margate. We're moving there. I've bought a house there. It's our kind of new location where we're going to be. Woo! But I didn't realise...
We don't need to know about your house. That's
fine. We've talked about my house.
Lovely, we all know you bought a house in Margate.
Anyway, I remember when the Turner Contemporary opened, which is a museum. It has free exhibitions. You can go there and see great shows. I walked in and I actually was... I stopped in my tracks because there was this book on the wall in neon, and slowly the pages of the book turn. And I didn't even know it was you immediately. I was just like, what is that work? Like, I loved it. Mm. And there was actually, yes, there's light in it, but it's white
neon.
It's an animation, effectively, yeah. And it isn't full of bright colours or anything, but it was the work that literally stopped me in my tracks. And I love the story behind it, which I've only just found out, to do with Margate as well, which I didn't realise. But how did that work come about with the book? Because it's so meaningful to me, that work.
The work that's there is the second version of it.
Yeah.
The first version was I won a competition, which was run, I think, by the Arts Council and the local council. And it must have been mid-70s, say 75, something like that. And it was the first time I ever did a public work. It was the first time I'd ever had the possibility of a commission, and I couldn't believe when I won the competition. It was for the new public library being opened in Margate.
Wow.
This was designer. That was a design you put in for your concept.
They asked for submission, and I think they asked a number of artists, maybe six artists, and I thought, you know, Margate, and they're going to want an anchor or something like that.
Yes,
and,
exactly, like and a sea theme.
But there's no possibility this is good, and I won. I couldn't believe it, and so the building was made of red brick, and there was the entrance to the library. You went up some steps, and there was the glass doors of the entrance to the library, and there was a brick wall, plain brick wall above the door. So I thought the book was just a perfect image for, and it's something welcoming about a turning page.
Yeah.
As it was a symbol for the library. Mm-hmm. That was the greeting for the library. It was meant to be like, because a lot of the things I do, they have an aspect of signage about them because they're so specific.
Mm. Yes.
And I just thought that was, and also there was something very nice about the turning pages because they were a bit like sails.
Oh, totally,
You know, if you think of the shape of them, they're very like sails.
Well, what I like about that work is the line on the edge of the book is obviously quite hard line.
Yes.
And that's also something I associate with you, is these kind of edges or, you know, hard lines somehow. But then the softness of the books, because it's almost like more fluid. There's another work you did, which is fries, you know, like almost like takeaway food, fast food, fries, where the fries themselves are kind of softer somehow, but you know, than
packaging.
Exactly. But I love that combination of the two, like juxtaposed together.
Well, there's something else nice about neon things, which is there's all the wires and everything like that. And I really liked all of the, I had done a whole series of works using white neon drawings in the mid 70s, which is where this thing, that thing coincided with that period. And that's why I did neon. But then what happened was the work was commissioned by Margate. As I remember, it was to commemorate a librarian who had been there for like 30 or 40 years and much loved figure. And he retired. Oh. Well, by the time the thing got on the wall, the people who had commissioned it had been turfed out of office because it was a change of party or something.
Oh, no way.
And nobody wanted it. Nobody liked it. Nobody understood what it... there was no interest in all...
The history
was gone because all the people who had made it happen were all gone. And so they never turned it on.
No way.
I'm not sure it ever worked.
Did the librarian see it?
I have no idea.
Oh my God.
I have no idea what happened to it.
But isn't there one of Margate's most... Was that what you were going to tell?
But what's really funny is then they tore down the library.
No way.
Yes.
The whole building
So this building that was new is now already gone. Mm. And of course the artwork went with this piece of neon that was meaningless, kind of neon that never comes on.
Luckily that there are photographs of it though. Yeah.
There are
from the time, and it was turned on once at least, because in the photo it looks like it's working.
Tracy has told me that she saw it.
Tracy Emin.
Tracy Emin, who is Margate, really. And she says she remembers it.
Oh, that's nice.
But then
amazing, because she works in neons.
Oh, yeah, exactly. Maybe, had some kind neon. Of subconscious.
Yeah, you're like, hang on a minute,
you're not
Tracy.
Kidding. Come on, you know, a little influence, it's okay. Tracy always says that I was her favorite tutor, even though I never taught her.
Oh, that's so cool.
But she was all of her peers' favorite tutors. So, yeah.
But then it was fantastic because when they were building the Turner Contemporary, the people doing the project learned about this thing and then asked me if I would redo it for the Turner Contemporary and to put it over the desk.
So great. So now it's returned to its original home.
So it's returned to its original home. I mean, it's such a nice story.
Me and Rob are going to get your edition.
Which was lost.
Yeah, because Victoria Pomery told me about this edition that you've made,
which is a
fundraiser.
Which is Turner Contemporary.
And we were looking at it last night together because Russ and I had dinner last night and we were like, actually, we need to buy that print because it's so perfect.
Yeah.
And I had this such a kind of...
We put it on our Instagram feed and then people can see
exactly.
it.
Exactly.
Yes.
But we love that. We love that work.
Absolutely.
And I think it's a really great one. And then the other experience I had was, weirdly, after my father died, and I went to a bookshop and I was quite miserable. And you had a new book that had just come out, which is called Drawings. And again, like, I looked at the cover and I was like, Michael Craig Martin, but it wasn't bright colours. It was just the line. And like black and white, you know.
It's a red, isn't it?
Yeah, red.
Oh, is it red on the cover?
Conceptual.
Yes.
Okay, it's a conceptual front cover.
It's a conceptual red.
Okay, so anyway, I saw the red line. But then when you open the book, it's literally like, it's a huge volume. I mean, it's a big book.
Big book.
Coffee
with
table.
With many different objects, everyday objects, quotidian objects, but all
There's
devoid
over 300.
Of colour. A 300, exactly. So it's a really great thing. And you can almost, I actually flicked it at the time, you know, like a flick book, and I went through it. And suddenly I started crying because it reminded me of my dad. Because it had all these objects like, you know, chairs, I don't know, all these different objects that just reminded me of
my dad.
Well,
it's the mundane and the everyday and what you like it because it's instantly recognisable and you live around it all the whole time.
Yeah.
You're kind of elevating it and celebrating it, but also still reducing it to what it is.
When I do the drawings, I do the drawings the same way today as I did in 1978. I just draw the thing as I see it. I never draw from memory. I draw from observation. And I'm not trying to make a cartoon. I'm not trying to make a personal expression. I'm just trying to actually make a recording of the image through drawing, just through line. And I draw everything the same, so I try to get rid of all the hierarchies of material, scale, money. Doesn't matter. Everything's drawn exactly the same. A paper cup you get free with your coffee is the same as a grand piano.
How many drawings have you got while you were saying there's 300 in that book? How many, your bank of drawings, because that's what you work from. Once you've created it, that's it, and it's in your kind of...
Yeah, there are a few hundred more. I mean, I thought when I started that there, you know, by this, if I, because it never occurred to me, I'd be still doing it now. I would have dropped dead if you told me then that I would be still doing it my age. But the fact is, I thought there'd be about 10, I'd have 10,000 by now. And that's not true because there aren't 10,000 objects. But there, it's like colors. There are a comparatively limited number of things. There's just unbelievable variations.
Right.
Numbers of variations. So if you, the most obvious one is the chair. The chair is the most variable of all the objects. I've drawn a lot of different chairs because they're so variable and they're such interesting things. But the reality is a chair is a chair is a chair. And once you've drawn one, you've drawn chair. And half the objects in the world are chairs. You know, I mean, you know, a book, you draw a book. That's all the, you've drawn all the books. Because there is, there isn't any significant difference between one book and another. And so, although the world seems like it's filled with things, they are variants.
You've distilled an object down to its one image, and that for you is enough.
And if you need an object that you can name, there's lots of objects which are partial or need a more specific context in order to be understood. I don't draw those things. I don't draw weird plumbing
U-bends and stuff.
Well, you could. I could probably draw a U-bend.
I could do a lovely U-bend.
You know, you see, the fact that you
I
say
U-bend. I would love to see your U-bend.
You would like that. And the thing is, the fact that you had a name for it that we could all recognize, that's a signal to me that I could draw it. That I could draw it. That's
Got
a very good indication of what I feel I can draw.
Well, if you so, if I see a work with a U-bend in now,
you'll know like, that you're responsible.
Toby's influence,
That's really...
The other great thing about that drawing book was the idea that you've created such a distinct image. Like, you know, your line is so Michael Craig Martin. It's got as much personality in a way as, you know, Tracy Emin's line, you know, it's that scratchy line of that she has or whoever, you know, which is very heavy personality in a way, like within that work. But your work, even though you've almost tried to get away from the personality, you know, because it's not, because it's these very like strict kind of lines in a way, but that's become so iconically yours.
That is the great irony of what I've done, because when I started, I wanted to make drawings that were completely styleless and impersonal.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's why I made them, I drew them right from the very beginning. I drew them with tape, so there's no inflection, there's no indication of my hand, there's no obvious signs of individual authorship. And I thought, this is the most neutral thing I could possibly do. And it's turned out to be my style.
Yeah. And
it's
also,
instantly recognizable.
Yeah.
And it's the absolute opposite of what I
set out to do. Yeah. And it's funny how much it's influenced culture. Like, I was looking in my kitchen the other day, Ottolenghi cookbook, and on the back of it, it's got all these line drawings of vegetables and fruit or whatever. And I was like, Michael Craig Martin. And then I was drying my hands in a bathroom the other day on a Dyson, you know, one of those fancy hand dryer things. And on the top of it, it has drawings, obviously promoting their Hoovers, but they're like Michael Craig Martin's. And I see it everywhere I go now. It's like this funny thing.
I have to say, I see it, of course, too.
Yeah.
A lot. And I also think that there's certain things that I've done with color, which I also see
around.
You know, that it's not surprising that what I do a lot of designers, graphic designers and furniture designers, people who make the things that I like what I do and are attracted to it. It's that's not surprising. So I can see that I have I've had an influence in their world.
Yeah.
Because,
and I can imagine in architecture as well, because you've done all those amazing diptych works where you've got like a Mies van der Rohe chair and then a Mies van der Rohe building or something.
I'm very interested in architecture. Yeah. I like the made world.
Yes.
Yeah.
The made world. And buildings are really big objects, you know, I've drawn things which are very, very ordinary, you know, light bulbs and paper cups where you don't know who designed them. They're kind of everywhere and they're ubiquitous. And nobody, what is the history of this object? And then there's other things that are very specific to a particular designer.
Design pieces.
Absolutely precise and instantly recognizable as that individual person's. So I don't make a distinction between those things. I treat them all the same way.
Mm. Right.
And I'm not particularly interested in kitsch, but some objects are kitsch and some objects are not.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not interested in consumerism as there are lots of people interested in consumerism as a construct. I'm not interested in
consumerism. Through color as well, you don't conform to the identity of a piece. You always play with the colors. What you assume would be the color of the piece, you juxtapose that.
What I discovered with the color was I restrict myself totally when I'm doing the drawings to the object.
Mm.
When it comes to the color, it's exactly the opposite.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
I take every freedom I want.
We should segue on to something which you're very well known for now, which I'm interested in. Well, you're as a teacher. Basically, a lot of people have made you the master teacher, the legend, that the inspiration for so many of our artists that are working today. You were there at the forefront in their formative kind of decisions and choices, and you were critiquing them and assisting them and, you know, making them who they are now. How do you feel about being given this mantle?
Well, of course, it's extremely flattering to think that, you know, people think like that about my time teaching. I mean, when you're teaching, one has to say if you're teaching in art school, the one thing you would like, or that I wanted was, I saw it as a kind of mission that I just assumed they wanted what I wanted. And to a certain extent, I had in those days much more of it than they did because they were just students.
What is it you want? What was it?
I wanted to be an artist. I wanted to be an artist in the world. I wanted to be able to have a life as an artist.
Mm-hmm.
And I assumed that all my students, that's what they wanted.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And that my job was to help them
facilitate that
and
dream.
See that could be a realistic possibility.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, it's not a realistic possibility for a lot of people. And a lot of people who go to art school, of course, don't become artists, or become artists at different levels, different ways.
Mm-hmm.
But to me, it's entirely irrelevant in the end whether somebody does become an artist, because I think art education is a form of education that enables people
to be
highly adaptable, mm-hmm. to be mm-hmm. very creative no matter what they do,
mm-hmm.
because it's based in self-knowledge.
Yeah.
And as you know, self-knowledge is the key really, to everything.
Well, it's exploration of the soul, which is a Tracy Mintar. Sorry to drop that in, but that's exactly what it is. And that's what's terrifying in today's day and age when they're going to strip school education of art, of drama, of that ability as a human to express yourself from your core.
If you go to the most conservative educational theorists, what they talk about is we want people to be flexible, adaptable to changing circumstances, independent-minded, every single thing
mm-hmm.
that is described as the aim of contemporary education.
Mm-hmm.
is in art education.
Mm-hmm.
Mm.
It's primary in art education.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, that's the form of education that they're getting rid of.
Yeah. They want to cut.
They want to cut.
Yeah.
Anything with any depth that's spiritual, anything surface, keep it.
Anything that allows the spirit to find its desire.
Yeah.
Mm.
Because there's a thing, I mean, to be honest, there's a kind of thing in education anyway, which is that if something isn't really crushingly difficult. It's not worth doing. Mm-hmm. And the reality is, in life, you cannot build a life on doing something you hate. Mm. You do that, and you're going to have a miserable life.
Yeah,
exactly.
If you can find a way of living that's based in something that you love, that you really wish to do, that this is the happiest thing. These are the happiest people in the world.
True.
And
put my hand in the air on that.
I'm
one.
Putting my hand up.
Yeah,
too.
I mean, there you are. You see,
we both followed.
But it's obvious in the conversation. You see that we're all people who live in this way. Mm. But the terrible thing is, in our society, this is quite a privileged position.
Totally. Yeah. Mm.
But there's absolutely no reason why that isn't possible.
Accessible
for everybody. And you don't have to be an artist to.
No, I
to
agree
have
completely.
That thing. But the problem is that so few people have access to something which allows them to actually consider, what do I really want?
Yeah.
And people often resist the thing that they love or that they're very good at. Mm. It's amazing. People resist what they're good at. This is the strangest thing of all, because people who are good at something when you say they're good at it, it means they find it comparatively easy.
Mm.
The fact they find it easy devalues it for them.
Mm-hmm. Totally.
Yeah, yeah.
It's ridiculous.
If you're not working hard at something, then it can't possibly be worth it.
If it comes easily, it can't be valuable.
No.
Yeah.
And very often people think, I can do this thing quite easily,
so I should do something else.
But everybody else must be able to do it easily,
exactly,
too.
Yeah.
When in fact, what they're able to do easily may be really quite unusually difficult for everybody else.
Yes.
Yeah.
But they don't recognize that. This is the most tragic thing in education.
Which, you know, is in a way why teaching is so important. And I think it's probably like one of the most important things in like life is to have great teachers. You know, yes, doctors not as well, of course. But like I was saying to Russell last night, like if I think back to some of the teachers that helped me, there was one particularly when I was growing up. I mean, changed my life. Do you know what I mean?
Mm. And I think any of us must have teachers that who play this role. Mm. You know, somebody who just lights something up in you. And you don't know, you know, as a teacher, you don't know who that is. You don't know when it happens.
Yep. Mm.
I have people come to me and tell me something that I said to them 30, 40 years ago. And I, of course, I don't have the vaguest memory at all of what I said.
You said, yeah.
But they have lived with this memory for 30 or 40 years. This is a key thing.
Oh, that's fantastic.
And I, you know, to me, I was trying to say what I was saying.
Can I read a chapter out of your book? This is something about you, which is very, very short, but something which is out of the whole book has completely struck me. And it's called On Being Fair. Do you know what I'm talking about?
No, I don't know. I can't remember.
Halfway through my first year teaching at Corsham, I was called in by Rosemary Ellis, my head of department, for a chat. I had a group of students I saw 2 days a week, and another tutor, Jason, saw them on 2 other days. Rosemary said that the students had told her that I was a better teacher and they much preferred my classes. It just isn't fair on Jason, she complained, requesting that I moderate my teaching. Needless to say, this came as a shock. Absolutely nothing in my American education had prepared me for such a request. As I had no idea how to carry it out, I simply ignored it. I just think that is, for me, I was like, what sort of world are we in that Rosemary Ellis would sit you down and be like, you're a fantastic teacher. Be less fantastic.
Be less fantastic.
Because I'm feeling bad on the other teachers, not as good as you. So be as shit as him, please.
Yeah. I hate to say it, but I mean, is that her real name, by the way? That is from the very beginning when I was first in Britain in the 60s. And but there is an aspect of that thinking that runs through British culture, which is a kind of underdogism. Whereas if somebody is doing well at something, they are already getting too much attention.
Mm.
It's, you know, you don't need to help them. You don't need to support them because they're actually doing too well.
Yeah. Like what we have a little
to do,
less,
what we have to do is to help the other one who isn't really as good as that one.
You support,
It's a very strange...
It's the antithesis of the American... The American dream is we want you up there, stay up there, let's keep you up there, let's keep you up. Whereas England's like, we want you up there, you're up there, get off off the pedestal, you've got to make room for someone else who isn't as good as you, please.
Exactly.
If you're too good, then that means the next person's not going to be able to shine as much.
Yeah. Americans love people to be on pedestals.
Yes.
And Americans, I mean, there are good and bad aspects of this, of course. Americans like to stand right next to somebody who's very successful.
Because it's like
you're going to catch the success germ. But my aim in teaching was to give as many people as possible confidence in themselves, confidence in what they were doing, and that is so much a key thing. Well, so that must have happened to you, that there were things that happened that gave you confidence in what you were doing quite young. There were challenges, but there must have been things.
What it is for me is that you're bearing your soul, you're going out there doing it, and it's someone tapping you on the back and going, I'm really liking what you're doing, keep going. That's what it is. That's where the confidence comes from, is that you're going out there and you're expressing yourself, and someone lets you know that your expression of yourself is something that other people want to enjoy.
Yeah.
To keep doing it. And that's the most kind of confidence building thing you can do as a kid, as myself, as in my formative years.
Yes.
It's just someone to just hold my hand and go, yeah, keep going, keep doing that.
Yeah.
Which you might not get if you don't get that outlet, if you don't know that you've got that place to explore, then how are you going to have someone hold your hand and go, right, go down that path? You can do that.
Yeah.
It's amazing the impact of it. It keeps one going. It keeps one...
Oh my totally. God, it's fuel.
Do you know what? For me, when I used to make pop music for about 15 years, and then I stopped when I was 29, but I was adamant I wanted to become a gallerist. And it felt like the one place that I felt like I belonged was the art world. And I really wanted that to be able to promote art and make it make sense for people, because I kept coming up to people who'd be like, contemporary art, what does that mean? What is that? What a waste of time, all that. And it meant so much to me that I wanted to be the person that could be in between the artwork and the world or whatever. And Maureen Paley was a really big influence on me. And she was one of the people that really encouraged me to almost have this big change in career.
Yeah.
And then also Neil Tennant from Pet Shop Boys. I remember him saying to me that I was 29, and he said, like, you should just do this, because if you believe in art that much, you need to do it, because you will, this decision you make now at 29, I think when he started Pet Shop Boys, it was the same age. Mm. And he said, the decisions you make now will be like really important for you. And to hear it from those people was like, I'm going to do that. Mm. You know,
you needed to arrange and bring order to this world that you were inspiring for other people.
Yes.
You needed to articulate it
for
the people that were struggling to understand it.
Yeah, you felt
like that. You certainly felt like you had a responsibility.
It felt like a mission.
Yeah.
I loved it so much. Yeah. And, you know, it is really important to have people who mentor you or support you in the way you want to.
But also, I think there's something also very important what you're saying, which is that it's never too late to do something.
Agreed.
You know, I mean, as I said, I was in my 50s when I introduced color into my work. The work that you know me for, you think it goes back my whole career. It doesn't.
Yeah.
It's 25 years out of, 60.
Yeah.
Mm. And things can change very, very, very dramatically in one's life, at any stage in one's life. A lot of life has to do with grasping opportunities. And the difference between different people is some people grasp the opportunity that comes to them, and other people let the opportunity slip by. You know, when the YBAs were first gaining success, which they did so early, they were terribly young, and none of them, you know, have MA, ever went to an MA course. They all only have BA degrees. Mm. And, you know, some of them are in their very early 20s, and they're starting to have international recognition. Mm-hmm. And I had many people in the art world say to me that it was terrible because they were too young to have, this was very dangerous for them because they were too young. Mm. And I said, well, you know, I'm sure you're right. But the fact is the door has opened for them.
Yeah.
It's a tangible thing.
And I would say, go through the door.
Absolutely. Yes, exactly.
Because if you say, well, wait a second, I'll come back in 3 years and then I'll go through the door.
Yeah.
Believe me, the door won't be open in 3 years.
Yeah.
The door is open for the moment that it's open,
exactly.
And you have to go through it.
Yeah.
And if you don't,
who knows?
It's not going to happen again.
Yeah.
And when the opportunity comes, you have to take it.
Yeah.
And that was a big door. There was a lot of them jumped through that.
Yeah, I know. It was wide open.
That was
and for those listening who don't know who the YBAs are, it's people like Damien Hirst, Gary Hume, Sarah Lucas. It was Liam Gillick. It was that kind of, they were the artists you were teaching. Matt Collishaw, Abigail.
Tracy Emin.
Abigail Lane.
Yeah, Abigail Lane. Tracy, all these people.
Michael Landy, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Michael Landy, I love
Gillian Waring.
Gillian Waring. All this sort of generation, yeah.
There was a lot of, the thing that was so exciting about the time was the number of people.
Yeah.
Mm. It was just astonishing, really. And it was a real game changer.
It didn't feel like there was a finite amount of success either. It didn't feel like, right, you've made it, that's
it. But you know,
it felt like there was just...
I always give Damien a lot of credit for that expanding characteristic of the thing, because the thing that initiated the YBA success was Damien's exhibition in 88 called Freeze, which was in a building in the Docklands. And there were, I don't know, maybe, I think there were 18, 20, 22 artists in it. And Damien was at Goldsmiths. He was a second year student at Goldsmiths, and he organized this exhibition in the summer. And everybody in the exhibition was either at Goldsmiths or had recently left Goldsmiths. So they were the people he knew from his world. The exhibition got a great deal of attention. And then over the next couple of years, he curated other big exhibitions. In each of them, some of the people who were in Freeze, he would include. And then over that period, he'd met other people who went to other colleges, people who did it. And so instead of what you might have expected to have, you have this success and you immediately hunker down and you protect yourself and you protect your own,
like,
and
you
don't want to share it out. He did the absolute opposite. He expanded the number of people who were engaged in the success. So the world kept multiplying.
Right.
So each time people did things, that it opened the world to another group of people. And I can remember having a collector visit me and say, you know, I've just come from seeing one of those artists, and they said the most amazing thing happened. We've been all over the world. It never happened to us before. This art, when we had our conversation with this person and we really liked the work, I'm going to buy something. But then they said, do you know so-and-so? And they said, no, we never heard of him. Listen, I got to take you there because he's really terrific. And this artist took them to see an artist they'd never heard of.
Right.
Well, they said, this is just never happened.
Mm. Yeah.
And there was something about the atmosphere at that time of sharing.
A community.
Yeah. Of a community sharing this success.
Yeah. Yeah,
and that made the period very, very special.
And you know what? I think in 2018, that is a really good message, you know, for everyone to be thinking about. And there's a gallerist in London who recently hosted an event for other gallerists in the summer at like lunch, and she invited like so many different gallerists of all different ages, you know, different people who work in the galleries, not even just like the directors of the galleries. It was very inclusive. And I remember thinking and sitting in that meal and just thinking, this is exactly what we need right now for the art world. You know, we all need to be together and be unified more than ever before. I think so over the last decade, maybe, I feel like everything was getting more and more separate and people were getting bigger and bigger and bigger.
Well, it's dog eat dog, isn't it? And it's got to be dog feed dog.
But now we've got to be together, because otherwise what is the point? And why did we all get into the art world? Because we felt we belonged to something and we had a shared belief in something. And, you know, and at the end of the day, it's about art and artists.
And there's much more success eventually comes from
and happiness.
Working together
yeah.
than it does from fragmenting things. And what happened with the YBAs is absolute proof of this.
Exactly.
The success that was generated by the group became greater and greater in engaging more and more people. And everybody rose with the...
Yeah.
As the temperature went up, everybody was carried.
So nice.
Yeah.
So we have two more questions which we're going to ask all our guests. So when it comes to free public institutions, do you have a touchstone artwork which you regularly visit?
Because we read in your book again that you loved the idea that in British culture people would maybe go to the National Gallery every day of the week, or you know, a few days a week, and go to look at one work that they really loved, and then they'd go to work or whatever. And it was almost like, even if you can't collect, you know, there are free institutions where you can go and experience works, and we think that's really important. And I loved that idea. And I also got asked a question the other day about what my favourite film was, and for some reason I said Thomas Crown Affair, which I didn't even really realise. And then I was thinking, Art Heist, like what work would we all steal if we could and take it home with us? And for me, it's Frida Kahlo's My Birth, which I think is actually in the collection of Madonna, so I need to get around her house and,
okay. You put that and out do the Art Heist. Suddenly goes missing, we know where that is.
It's like, hi Madonna, I just stole your painting. But
what's your touchstone and what's your Art Heist?
Yeah.
Please.
It's very difficult. but you know, you have mentioned the National Gallery, and there is a painting there which I've done versions of myself. I played with, and it's Seurat's Bathers, you know.
Ah.
And I just love that painting. And every time
you did a diptych, didn't you?
I've done things. Yeah, yes. I've done a lot of things with it, and because it's a majestic painting of great. Of where all the characters, the people in it, are given a very particular sense of dignity. Mm. And it's ordinary people lounging on the banks of a river with factories in the background. They're obviously workers having a lunch break. And yet they're being given the kind of presence that you expect in a history painting of Napoleon or kind of grand historical figures. Mm. And it has a very curious thing, which is that everybody is looking in one direction off canvas as though there's something over there and you have no idea what it is.
Somebody drowning.
They're too calm.
Oh, they're too calm. Somebody they don't like.
But it's very, very, they're very,
their
very
boss
still.
From the factory.
There's an incredible stillness in the painting. And it's something about... You know, it goes back to the question of ordinary objects. There's a kind of dignity in this painting,
yes,
which raises this ordinary scene
yeah.
to a kind of majestic level.
Regal.
Really.
What year was that painted?
I love
that.
It was painted 18-something, and it was, and I think he was 23.
Whoa. And that's in the National Gallery.
Yes.
And that's another one that's free to get into. And
you can just go in. And I have to say, the National Gallery has more fantastic paintings than almost any place else on earth.
Agreed, yeah.
But I never go in there without having to look at that painting.
Is there a
bench in front? I go and see other things. There can be. There sometimes is. Like,
yeah. And what would you steal? Would you steal that one if you could?
Oh, well, that would be very nice to have.
Lovely. Lovely. Well, it has been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so
thank
much.
Thank you so much.
Well,
I feel
thank
super
you guys.
Inspired
it's been,
right
it's been
now.
Very, you've made me feel so comfortable. God knows what I've said.
you've been very controversial.
Very controversial.
We've been reading from your book, Michael Craig Martin, On Being an Artist, which is published by art/books, which is available on all good reputable online booksellers, and your local bookstores should order it in.
Yes.
And what else was we covering? In the drawings book we saw in a Tate bookshop yesterday, but your drawings book as well should be available online as well, and you can get that ordered in.
And we will be sharing images of Michael's work on our Instagram @talkart.
Yes.
Yes, and can I just add one thing? I'm not sure when this is going to be broadcast, but I have been commissioned to do the Connaught Hotel Christmas tree.
Yes!
Outside the hotel.
Perfect.
And at the end of November.
Love it.
Yes.
I was actually going to say to you, because you made that comment in the book about your latest work of art always feeling like it's your best and the most important. So I actually meant to say to you what was the latest work of art. It's a Christmas tree.
Great. So the Connaught Hotel is in Mayfair, and this will be seen as a public...
It's a 30-foot Christmas tree outside the hotel.
Awesome.
On Mount Street.
Perfect.
And
that's free to look at as well.
So, let's hope that it works. I'm doing something that's turned out to be technologically rather difficult and challenging. And of course, all I can do is say, I hope you guys can do it, because I'm not capable of doing it myself.
We should all go and check that out. That's amazing.
I'm really excited about
it. It'll be worth seeing.
Yes. Wonderful.
Well, thank you so much. It's been such a privilege to spend time with you. And
And your tea's gone cold. I poured you tea earlier on, so have a sip of that.
Oh.
But big love.
Thank you, Michael. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Talk Art with Robert Diamant and Russell Tovey. Follow us on Instagram at TalkArt, where you can view images of all artworks discussed in this episode. Recorded at Spiritland London by Anthony Shaw and edited by Gareth Isles. Subscribe to TalkArt on iTunes and Spotify. Give us a rating and write us a comment. Thanks for listening.
Mom deserves better than a drugstore card. This Mother's Day, surprise her with a truly special personalized card from Moonpig. Add your favorite photos, a heartfelt message, and we'll even mail it for you the same day, all for just $5. From mom to grandma, we have something to celebrate every mom in your life. Every mom deserves a Moonpig card. Get 50% off your first card at Moonpig.com.
Moonpig.com.